You're a little older and a lot wiser. The future is yours. Define aging on your own terms. Welcome to AARP Without Limits with your host, Mike Olander.
Hello and welcome. This is AARP Without Limits, WPTF Talk Radio. We are disrupting aging one show at a time with all of our podcasts available anytime on demand at WPTF.com. or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Mike Olander of AARP North Carolina. We've got a great show for you today, folks. Yet again, political commentator and lobbyist Joe Stewart returns to the show, this time to talk about the state's political environment in 2025, how it differs from the past, and what he is paying closest attention to. But first, as always, ladies and gentlemen, I'm joined here in the studio by my dear friend, colleague, no, not quite colleague, partner in crime, esteemed production engineer here at WPTF, Mr. Jason Kong. Jason, how are you today, my friend?
Mike, it's good to see you again. I mentioned this before the show, so of course no one heard it, but you've lost the beard. You were growing a good-sized beard for a while.
I did. I've grown it in
for you.
For me, for sure. Yeah. So I'm gone. Yeah, I got to that point where I'm like, I'm starting to feel itching. When you have a beard, you start it and it gets itchy and then you get used to it and you don't feel it. And then you have some days I found where it's just like, and I'm like, I don't need to do this right now. And plus, so anyway, thanks for noticing. And yeah, we're on this schedule now every a couple of weeks now, as opposed to weekly, which, we got to get used to this new cadence. Not the best one, I have to say, Jason. It was always great seeing you every week. But how are you? How's your family?
Family is good. Our daughter just turned one. We had another birthday as well. My middle son turned 5, Arthur. So, yeah, it's just been lots of cake and cupcakes everywhere and goodie bags. We got like a nice birthday gap here coming up, so I'm looking forward to that.
Good stuff. Oh, that's nice to hear. Yeah, a big year for my family for sure. My son turned 15 the beginning of January, and a couple weeks later he got his driver's permit. So
Wow. It's
been, you know, you have milestones when you're, you know, an adult parent, a grandparent, what have you, with your kids, first steps. Hey, they're out of diapers now. That's a big deal. They started school. They're in middle school. They start high school. Driving is a big one, as I found out, because I'm just like, okay, here are the keys to the Ram 1500. Let's see how this goes with you, that
now,
Hemi.
Now, was he excited? Because from what I've heard, a lot of kids these days aren't really that motivated to get their license or their permit early. They just kind of rely on
this
Uber.
This is definitely not the Dukes of Hazzard generation anymore, for sure. No, but he was excited.
Cool.
And he's been doing really, really good. And I got to say, I've had my truck a little over a year now, and it's taken me many months to get used to parking that thing. And he's doing pretty well for a newcomer with it. Anyway, yeah, big year with that. And also, Jason, this has been an interesting month for me because I am in the final throes of my 40s. And that may sound like quite a surprise to our listening audience, thinking the director of AARP North Carolina, just not even 50 yet. I mean, what's the deal with that? But yeah, in my last couple of weeks, and it's been interesting. And I have to say, for me, and forgive me, I know this is one of these types of things where everybody goes through their own journey, and why is mine any more significant than anybody else's? It's not. But my little story is, I've been at AARP about 18 years now. And before that, about 7 years working in similar space, especially with older adults working on advocacy issues. That's now half of my life in my career, which has been, for me, that's kind of another milestone. And then, this last year, Jason, I got to be honest, it's been an interesting year. It's been a bit challenging. I turned 49. I'm like, wow, maybe age. I know we always say age is just a number and so on and so forth. But of course, as you know, that's a little bit more than that. You have to deal with new things for the first time, and things hit home because you're now dealing with them personally, especially with physical issues and things like that, right? But for me, it's like, I've always had this thing in my life where I've always been associated with the youth, right? I'm the baby of 5 kids. There's 7 years between me and my next oldest. So I've always been the baby in the family, regardless of how old I really am. And then I've always looked young for my age. So, and in a way, that's been a good thing in my life because it means I've got to work harder to kind of prove that I belong to be at the table, you know? But anyway, that being said, it's been like, wow, I'm not the young guy anymore. I'm really not. I'm not a young adult. I'm not even, I'm exiting middle age. So it's been interesting, but I've adapted and I'm embracing it. I'm really looking forward to it. So no significance to losing the beard, though I have to say the beard does add some years onto me, especially I notice how gray it's gotten. So anyway, all that being said, I'm excited about it, Jason. We got one more show before I'm in the big 5-0, and then I'm officially part of the club. So very interesting. But I want to also make one quick note before we start talking with our guest. Really looking forward to some of our content we're going to be having in upcoming months when in the month of May, which is Older Americans Month, we are really going to be doing a focus on aging stereotypes and how people do break the mold. It is important to realize that people do define aging on their own terms individually. And culturally, we're way different than we were with your parents or grandparents. And there's a lot to be said for that. And so we're going to be highlighting that in the AARP Bulletin, which is the newsprint that goes out. There will be a special North Carolina section focusing on that in May and talking about AARP Without Limits as part of that. So nice hand-in-hand work we've got going on there with the AARP Bulletin. So that being said, Jason, you know, this has been a big year, not just for those of us with families and those of us turning 50, but wow, talk about change. A lot of big change going on, of course, since Election Day, both nationally and here in the state. A lot of interesting dynamics to think through and to observe. And to help us navigate some of this and to better understand this, there is nobody really better here in the Triangle area to talk to about this than our guest today, Joe Stewart. He's the VP of Government Affairs at the Independent Insurance Agents of North Carolina. He's a lobbyist. He is a political commentator. He's been around a while, seen a lot of things here in North Carolina, and Joe, welcome back to the show. It's great to have you again.
Yeah, thanks so much. I'm looking forward to this conversation.
And here in person this time, not via Zoom.
Absolutely. Well, I was thinking the last time when I zoomed in, I pulled into the parking lot for today's session, and for some reason I started craving Chick-fil-A, and I realized that the last time I was on with you, I was parked at Chick-fil-A.
So just no
operant
kidding.
Conditioning, I was like immediately associating Chick-fil-A with the program.
It's amazing. Wow. Okay. Well, we'll arrange for some Chick-fil-A the next time he's here, Jason. We'll have to do that. Really happy to have you with us, Joe. When we had you on the show last time, it was just after the March primary. And I remember at the time there was a lot of commotion over the voters' choices at that time. I remember, especially on the Republican side, the state chamber had some pretty very strongly worded statement that came out. As it turns out, that was just the beginning of what was a very interesting election year here in the state. Looking back, did things on Election Day turn out as you were expecting, and what stood out to you the most?
The interesting thing in North Carolina, the 2024 election cycle, three really important criteria for consideration. One, we know that the state is a highly competitive place on a statewide basis that it referred to as a purple state. And we have some history of voting for Democratic candidates for statewide office and then voting for Republican candidates for federal office. So voting for the Republican candidate for president while perhaps voting in a Democrat for governor, which has certainly happened. The interesting dynamic with Mark Robinson as the Republican candidate for governor, there were so many significant issues associated with his candidacy that the final outcome in the governor's race was nearly a 15 percentage point margin between he and Josh Stein, the Democrat. So for a state that's considered to be purple, that's crazy. A 5% margin of victory is a landslide in a state like North Carolina. Right. So the question was, with those sorts of separations, and we felt that in the polling and what was being said about the governor's race 30 to 45 days out from the election, suddenly people were saying, will this be a blue wave election for Democrats down ballot because of Josh Stein doing so much better than his Republican opponent, Mark Robinson? And it didn't really come to pass. I mean, there were three Council of State seats that went Democratic that maybe there was a little implication from what was going on in the governor's race. But Donald Trump, the Republican candidate for president, won the state handily by margins similar to what he had achieved 8 years earlier. That didn't seem to have a significant down ballot impact. Republican, the second real dynamic, the Republicans in the legislature really desiring to keep supermajority number 72 House seats and 30 Senate seats. the races that came down to the handful of competitive contests that were going to make up that difference. Really, almost the Republicans in the Senate did maintain 30 seats, supermajority. Republicans came within one. They have 71 seats now. As the new Speaker of the House, Destin Hall, said, they have a practical supermajority. They probably can bring over one Democratic vote for a gubernatorial override, given whatever the topic is that is contentious there. But so the state still seemingly is very, very competitive from a partisan voting perspective standpoint. The interesting thing now is, of course, going into the 2026 election, we always say about politics, it's a little bit like the act of painting the Golden Gate Bridge. Getting done in an election just means the next election cycle has started. Like painting the Golden Gate Bridge, the span is so great. You've gotten to one side to the other. You've got to go back and start.
Time to start over on the other side again, right?
And so now the focus is, of course, 2026. Midterm elections historically go against the party in control of the White House. The significance of what are considered wave election dynamics will be seen. Voters expressed a lot of interest about economic issues in this presidential contest. Whether that remains the focus or some other concern arises between now and 2026, we have a U.S. Senate race. Tom Tillis, a Republican incumbent, will in all likelihood be on the ballot again in 2026. And so will we have some sort of wave dynamic that favors Democrats in North Carolina? So all of the dynamics between the Democratic governor, Josh Stein, the Republican leadership of the General Assembly, everything that's going on in the state politically, probably at least at some level, is all about the two parties positioning for 2026.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that Senate race, we'll get to that in a little bit. That's going to be fascinating for sure. Were you surprised? And at the time we're recording this, folks, the state Supreme Court seat that's up right now has got the Democrat ahead by 700-something votes.
Right.
If that holds true, would that be a surprise to you that she wound up eking out that victory?
Yeah, you know, the judicial races on the ballot are always tough. We have partisan designation, so a judge runs for the Supreme Court or Court of Appeals on a partisan basis. Typically, that's been to the benefit of Republicans over the last couple of cycles. In this case, Allison Riggs, who was the incumbent only because she'd been appointed to the seat, had never run. She'd been right on the Court of Appeals, but had run statewide as a judge before, but not in the Supreme Court. But having it be that close is not surprising, given the dynamics of North Carolina. The way this is playing out and the question as to whether voters should be disqualified from the votes that they cast is probably the more significant issue. But hopefully it gets resolved here in short order and we move on.
Okay. The state legislative season has started. We've got new leadership as well as, in the legislature, as well as a new governor and council of state. We also have new challenges, notably, of course, the Hurricane Helene recovery. When Stein was the attorney general, there was not a lot of publicly displayed affection between him and the state legislature, it seemed. What do you expect in this year, from the governor, legislative leadership, and what their relationship will look like?
Yeah, I think even when the partisan control of the General Assembly and the party of the governor are the same, there's tension. I mean, it's just an inherent feature of our form of government is that executives of the executive branch don't always agree with the leadership of the legislative branch. But I think in this particular regard, my expectation is this is going to be pretty acrimonious. Mm-hmm. And again, it goes back to that sense of the Republican leadership in the General Assembly very cautious about what 2026 might look like and don't want a Democratic governor to have what they would consider too many legislative wins, to give the impression that they're getting along too well with this Democrat who's in the governor's mansion. The big issues are really this. You mentioned it. It's Hurricane Helene relief. The governor announced he had $1 billion proposal for continued relief. The House just rolled out a proposal for $500 million more. The Senate will roll out. They'll do something in the legislature for additional relief for Western North Carolina, and I think that'll get resolved. The budget issues are going to be significant. There really is a challenge in terms of revenue collections going forward, about a $3 to $5 billion inefficiency in the collections to sustain what is necessary in the budget for the usual operation of state government. Something's got to be done to make sure that that's corrected. We don't want to hit that and unexpectedly have this incredible shortfall in the state budget. The question is, there are some proposals that would include things like expanding gambling in the state in one form or another as a way to generate additional revenue in lieu of taxation. There's a very strong support among some key Republican leaders for making medical marijuana legal in North Carolina. The past session, it passed the Senate, but not the House. And so the negotiations between the House and the Senate, even though they're both controlled by Republicans, will undoubtedly have the long shadow of medical marijuana cast upon it, just as the Senate continues to try to leverage things that the House wants in exchange for support for medical marijuana. So that may ultimately be what this session is entirely about, of whether the House and Senate can come to an agreement on whether or not marijuana for medicinal purposes should be legal in the state.
Fascinating, right? Who knew pot politics would carry so much weight and cut such a long shadow, as you said, over all these other priorities. When we return, folks, we're going to continue our conversation with Joe Stewart. This is AARP Without Limits. We'll be right back. And we are back. This is AARP Without Limits. Just a reminder, folks, that we always love to hear from you. If you have a question, a comment, a recommendation, or a suggestion for a future guest or topic, please send us an email, aarpwithoutlimits@aarp.org. We've been speaking today with Joe Stewart. He's the VP of Government Affairs at the Independent Insurance Agents of North Carolina. And Joe, we were talking before about a number of things. One of the things we haven't gotten into yet has been the Trump factor. And that's something that cannot be overstated, I think. In this first 3 weeks, we've seen quite a bit of things happening. Even after the election, when he cannot run again, Trump is casting a very large shadow over everything. North Carolina voters, however, as we talked a bit about before, has a history of electing both Republicans and Democrats as leaders. So how do you see that affecting state legislation this year? And how do you see Stein fitting into all this, considering, you know, a lot of governors come in, especially a 15-point margin. We haven't seen that here before. Make it a national name for himself with, you know, future aspirations. What's your take?
It's interesting. Anytime someone is president, they cast the image of themselves on their own party. And so Reagan became a feature, and the Republican Party became a reflection of Ronald Reagan, and then of George Bush, and then of George Bush younger. Donald Trump has installed himself really as the titular head of the Republican Party, and the dynamic of party politics is now about Trump and about the Trump agenda, the America First, as a priority. And the president has done a lot of stuff early on in his administration. They've signed a lot of executive orders, taken a lot of immediate action on things that Trump talked about on the campaign. And this is the delivery of what he promised. No one should be surprised that this was the priority. The one thing I think is different for us, Trump is not the scripted president that we're used to. I often think working in the Trump White House must be exhilarating because you really have no idea what the president's going to say on a daily basis about any particular thing. And so trying to measure it by comparison with previous presidential administrations is probably not appropriate. Now, people ask me from a historical standpoint, you know, is this a different kind of presidency? And I'm like, Andrew Jackson came into the White House as a very different kind of president, very populist. He had killed men in duels. He had married his wife before she was lawfully divorced from her husband. I mean, talk about scandal.
Right.
So this is not unprecedented. It's just not common in the modern era to have a president that is this way.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it is different. Now, the interesting thing is within the Democratic Party, there's a lot of hand-wringing about what went wrong in 2024 and what's the pathway forward and who are the probable standard bearers for 2028. As you pointed out, Trump can't run for re-election. It seems likely J.D. Vance, the vice president, will be the Republican nominee in 2028. Is there a consensus choice among Democrats now for who they would want as their candidate in 2028? Absolutely not. And in some part, it's the measure of why did Kamala Harris not do better? Why did Joe Biden remain the party's nominee or prospective nominee for so long if it wasn't really going to be possible for him to run for election for any number of reasons? So both parties are really at kind of an interesting place, but for very different reasons. But the one commonality between what Republicans face now and Democrats face now is very small, very vocal factions within those two parties are actually trying to lead things. The truth is the vast majority of North Carolinians and of Americans are relatively centrist.
Mm-hmm.
And so it is two, relatively speaking, extreme elements within the party trying to figure out a way to attract the middle. And that's a very difficult proposition to imagine. I don't think either party's quite figured it out yet. But frankly, voters have a tendency to focus on economic issues. As long as the economy remains relatively good, that would favor the party that's in control. Currently, Republicans control both the White House and Congress. If the economy remains relatively good, 2026 should be a good year for Republicans, despite the historical sense of wave elections and midterms. But going into 2028, if the economy remains strong, it probably will be a good year for Republicans for those historical reasons. That having been said, I guess it's always possible that the Democrats figure out what it is they want to be really about and create a message that attracts centrist voters. I think that's yet to be determined.
You know, it's interesting. That reminds me of after Mitt Romney lost to Obama, which was they were not prepared for, right? They really thought they were going to run away with it. There was that famous autopsy done where they said they would need to move to the middle more and attract more Latino voters. And Trump comes in and completely scrapped that idea, right? And I'm wondering if the same thing is I'm sure it's happening in different ways on the Democratic side and seeing, okay, is that actually going to wind up happening? And is that sort of the path forward for the two parties having that dynamic? So getting back to state legislation and what to expect this year, that Trump shadow, do you see it being, and again, more unique in North Carolina because we have a liberal Democrat governor.
Right.
And a near veto-proof majority of Republicans controlling the legislature. How do you wrap your head around that?
Yeah, we'll have to see. I mean, the initial projections. Governor Stein announced this week has not yet released his full budget, but will shortly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the legislature, again, regardless of partisan control, they always look kind of lovingly at what the budget proposals are of a governor and say, "Well, we'll figure this out. Don't you worry your pretty little head about it." But I think there's a real sense that there won't be the kind of availability that there has been in the last couple of budgetary cycles. So maybe a little austerity will create a point of consensus between the governor and the legislature and a need to make some hard choices about spending within the state. The determination of what's the best way for us to guarantee a reliable flow of revenue for the things people expect government to be able to do. And again, of course, whatever is going to be needed in addition to help Western North Carolina recover. We're fortunate Republicans, to their great credit, have built up a significant reserve fund, the rainy day fund, over $7 billion. They've appropriated out about almost a billion and a half of that for Helene relief. But all things considered, we're in pretty good fiscal shape as a state. So hopefully there's not that much to argue about. They can find some common ground on some big, more substantive public policy issues. The state continues to grow, 125,000 new residents a year. So there's a lot of infrastructure questions. What are we doing to make sure we can sustain that kind of growth? Are we making the investments that continue to assure North Carolina being competitive in a 21st century economy? Job training and creation of opportunities for people to provide for their families. Those are significant issues that have to be addressed if we want to continue to be a dynamic economy. So far, the conversations have not necessarily been about, are we doing the right stuff? We feel like we're successful because we continue to grow, but it's not something that's sustainable unless we're making the necessary investments to assure people moving here feel like that was a good choice.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned before with Helene, too. I'm personally hopeful that the Helene recovery is something that does wind up making the state just very functional, right, where there's a lot of bipartisan wins and the ribbon cuttings and all those things that happen, that they're not done in a partisan way, right, that there's sort of equal credit given around the board, and that helps bring the state together. Now, got to switch gears real quick. Soon after the election, Senator Tillis announced that he's running for re-election. Number one, did that surprise you that he's doing that? And two, the timing, which did surprise me, honestly. I didn't think it was going to be so quick.
Yeah, no, I every reason to believe that Senator Tillis is sincere in his desire to run. Of course, the filing period hasn't opened, but I think he will. He has already attracted one potential GOP primary rival, and I think there will be others. Senator Tillis has a significant challenge within the Republican Party. Many people feel like he's made some choices that they disagree with. He was censured by the state party for positions that he took when Trump was in office before. But Senator Tillis has a very interesting perspective. You know, he comes into this realm of politics as a business consultant. He was Speaker of the House, and so he understands governing and managing legislators. It's funny, when he was first elected to the Senate, I had the occasion to be with him and asked him if anything that he'd experienced as Speaker of the House had prepared him for the United States Senate. And he said at the time, he had gone to Mitch McConnell. Senator McConnell was the majority leader at that time, and said that Tillis said that he had some observations about ways that perhaps the U.S. Senate could operate more efficiently based on what he had done to reform the operations in the state house. And he said, McConnell's like, I hate it when House speakers get to be senators because they all think they know better. But the Senate is a very deliberative body. It moves very slowly. Mm-hmm. And Senator Tillis, I think, pretty early on found his footing. He's done some good work. He's worked collaboratively with Democrats in the Senate to get some good stuff done. The question is, who among the Democrats is likely to emerge as his opponent? I think Wiley Nickel, who served in the state Senate and then was in Congress for one term, chose not to run again because the district that he was serving in had been reconfigured not as favorable for a Democrat. I think it's my guess would be it's 110% sure that Wiley Nickel is a candidate for United States Senate. I personally don't think Roy Cooper is going to run for the Senate. I think Governor Cooper, who's been in public office 40 years now, is probably going to enjoy private life a little bit, practice law somewhere, do some big picture public policy kinds of things. But I would be very surprised if Cooper decides to run for public office again. Although, you know, I've been working with politicians most of my adult life. I give up trying to predict what makes them want to do the things they do. It may be that a course of events between now and then prompts Cooper to get in this. I just don't think it's very likely.
Yeah, and it would make sense for him not to. He's ending on a very good note, good approval and all of that. And like you said, plenty of options for him in the private sector. And my gosh, to say, yeah, let me get into this mess in Washington. Yeah. And they have to be worrying about fundraising and all this other type of stuff. Yeah. But like you, nothing would surprise me at this point. Now, you've been in this game a long time, Joe. You've seen a lot. And I know our paths and our work is very different. But I'm pretty sure we share a broad professional goal that you just want to see get done.
Right.
You want to see people's lives improved. You want to see things work efficiently. You want North Carolina to continue to be a place where people want to move to and to grow and give us all opportunities. Now, but we're in a crazy environment, very different from what you've experienced in the past. Is it changing the way you approach the work and how you approach legislators or your messaging is like from your organization? Tell me about that.
Yeah, you know, in the trajectory of my career, I grew up in Raleigh and went to live in Washington, D.C. after college and came back to the state in 1996, was assistant secretary of the Department of Public Safety at that time, and worked on a lot of initiatives, juvenile justice reform and domestic violence, enhanced the statutes relative to how we assist domestic violence victims, reformed the state's drunk driving laws. I mean, a lot of stuff. And it was always based on bringing together people who had very different opinions on those matters of public policy and figuring out what it was they could agree to and then proceeding. And generally speaking, I would say, as you well know, the best public policy comes about when you get people of differing opinions to recognize what it is they agree to. That's just the way this stuff works. Mm-hmm. I'd say that the partisan rancor right now probably makes that harder to do in a conspicuous way. It used to be the premium from a public communication standpoint was to say, this idea came about as opposed to competing interests finding common ground. That's still the way it works. That's not the way you can describe it.
That's right, yeah.
And so you have to figure out, you have to be, as my father once told me, the key to being clever is to be clever a lot. So you have to figure out what is the right way to do the hard work that makes good public policy happen, but recognize that there's got to be a different way of describing what you did to get to the results you want. I still find, and I work at the legislature when they're in session almost on a daily basis, it still does happen that Democrats and Republicans come together and figure out what they can agree about and where they want the state to be. It just has to be described and handled in a slightly different way. Mm-hmm. But I say this to my younger lobbying colleagues, you have to remain committed to the sincerity of the purpose of getting good public policy. It may be more difficult to get accomplished. It's still just as important as it ever was.
Mm. Yeah, you know, we've had elected officials on this show, state and federal, and it's amazing. I always like to ask them about behind the curtain, what's your take on the bipartisan? It's like, oh yeah, we all get along. Like, genuinely, I mean, there's exceptions, but genuinely, yeah, they are. But, you know, with the mechanisms you need to, with fundraising and and messaging coming from different levels. It's you know, you kind of have to play the game and do that. But I think people genuinely would be surprised to learn, really, it's not nearly as volatile as you would think, where people aren't getting in. There have been times in American history where there were people getting in fist fights. Yeah, and, absolutely. Right? I mean, the whole left-right thing came with the British Parliament, was it, where they put them in the left and the right to keep them physically separated? We are a long way from that, though the messaging sometimes you wouldn't get that sense. Joe, thanks so much for being here. Really absolutely. A pleasure. And like I mentioned before, you work in the insurance field. There's a lot to talk about that, so we're going to have you come talk about home insurance and all other sorts of stuff out there that I know folks would like to learn more about. Yeah,
glad to come back anytime. Enjoyed it sincerely.
Great. Joe, well, one last question. How can people, are you on social media? How can people follow you or your organization?
I don't do as much. I will mention one thing because you brought up this about your son. Real quickly, I'm also the chair of the board of the North Carolina Alliance of Safe Transportation, which is an organization that promotes better driving behavior. For anyone, you included, the most important thing with young drivers is make sure they're getting lots of practice. We think of young people as being daredevils and taking extreme risk. The truth is, the mistakes that young motorists make are often just because they don't know. And so letting them practice, letting them drive, getting the experience is the best way to make sure that they can respond to a real-world event when it occurs, because that's the mistake that they often make, overcorrecting when they run off the curb or not knowing how to respond in a traffic situation because they don't have any experience. Mm-hmm. So take your son out, drive with him, give him good advice. Let him have experience. That'll make him a better driver.
Great. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is a preview of perhaps our next conversation with Joe Stewart. Joe, thanks again so much for being with us. Thank you to Jason Kong for production. Thank you for listening. This has been AARP Without Limits. We'll catch you next time.